Mark chapter 10. I don't think we'll finish all the way through it. We'll get most of the way through it. I have to warn you, there are a couple of rabbit trails. I think they're worth pursuing. We said this every time we run up against Jesus repeating himself. We said, when God repeats himself, take note. Because he only repeats himself because he knows we need to hear it more than once, which I find incredibly kind. I mean, doesn't he, he's God, okay? Doesn't he have a right to say, look, I told you, that's it. But he repeats himself. And so we get to see him doing that today. And it's not other people's problem that they forget what God says at the important times. It's our problem, isn't it? It's so easy to laugh at the disciples because they're such bozos sometimes. But so am I. How many things have I had to apologize for later for worrying and freaking out about something that he had told me what to do when it happened and I just forgot? So we get to see him predicting his death in great detail once again. I don't know how it could be any clearer. He's on his way to Jerusalem. One of the things that happens when you go to Israel, like we're going, is you can never read the Bible the same ever again, because now there's pictures in your mind. Now you know exactly what the terrain looks like. They're on their way, winding their way up where we'll be going right before we stop at Abraham's tent and have a wonderful dinner and go for a camel ride. Thousands of people are making the very same journey as Jesus is headed up toward Jerusalem for Passover. There's only a couple of main ways in Jesus' day to get there. The easy way for most of Israel was just to shoot right straight down the lowlands along the Jordan River, then all the way down in the plain and down to about where the Dead Sea is. And then once you hit Jericho, there's a route that goes up through the mountains, because you're going to climb 1,500 feet above sea level in elevation up to Jerusalem. When we studied the Psalms, I don't know if you can remember it, but when we studied the Psalms, there's a whole songbook in the Psalms of songs that you sing on that part of the journey. We'll sing some of them. We are taking a guitar if they'll let us get it on the plane. So picture throngs of people, Jesus and his disciples headed on that familiar journey that every Jew had to make once a year. Some of the heads of the families had to go three times a year for all the major feasts, but at least on Passover they had to be there. It was a festive time, and in the economy that they were under, that was where you met God, because that's where God hung out. So going to Jerusalem was a completely different deal than it is for us. We get to take him with us when we go. But for them, it was, so there's all these mixed emotions going on at the same time. And of course, if I ever read this, we'll get right to this, the statement of this in this passage, starting at verse 32, Mark chapter 10. I'll just read as far as we're going to go, and then I'll make my comments. They were on their way up to Jerusalem, with Jesus leading the way. The disciples were astonished, sort of like walking in a daze. Of course, they're thinking it's going to be coronation day. While those who followed, that's the other pilgrims that were there, were afraid. And again, he took the 12 aside, and he told them what was going to happen to him. Every place that I have this, because I think one of the Gospels mentions 9 times he told them, and they still forgot. But I always write in the margins, after the second time, I always write the word why. It says, again, he told them. And I think, why? They're not listening. Tells you a lot about his heart. So he took them aside, told them what was going to happen to him. Listen to see if this is confusing and hard to understand, okay? We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, that's the Romans, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. What is so hard to figure out about that? It's as clear as it could be, isn't it? Now, you need to insert Matthew 20:20 in here, because Matthew gives us one little hint about this next little vignette that Mark leaves out. It says, Mark says, verse 35, that James and John then, the sons of Zebedee, came to him and they asked a question. But Matthew tells us they came with their mom and they made their mom ask the question. You weenies. Man up, you guys. Get your mom to do this. But I'm going to read what it says in Matthew, because it's one of our little rabbit trails today. The mother of Zebedee, and the NIV kind of misses it a little bit, so I'm going to read a combination of the English translations from Matthew 20:20 here. It says, the mother of Zebedee's sons, James and John, came to Jesus with her sons, worshiping in order to ask him a favor. That phrase just jumps out and hits me in the face. So we'll spend some time talking about that, because it's a common problem that church people have. And it's so unnecessary. Mark just says James and John came to him. I don't know why he leaves out the fact that it was their mom that actually posed the question. They said, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Oh man, I know churches that teach that. That's what's so pathetic. But isn't that childish? Have your kids ever come up to you and said, okay, I want you to promise me that what I'm about to ask you, that you'll say yes? And you didn't just fall off the turnip truck. You know, wait a minute, I want to know what you're going to ask. Isn't this funny? Now, Jesus, in Jesus' name, we want you to give us whatever we ask. And I, in my version of this, I see him smiling right here, just like you would to your children. Because you know how put a childish question that is. And he says, what do you want me to do? And I always see him smiling. They said, now once again, their mom is the one that phrases the question, which they put her up to. Let one of us sit on your right and the other on your left in your glory. Title of our study today is these next words of Jesus. You don't know what you're asking. And Jesus said, can you drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? Typical guy answer, we can. Bring it on, baby. That's like if he says, can you wrestle these 10 grizzly bears? Yeah, of course, we can. Come on, bring them on. You will drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared, and Matthew adds, by my Father. When the 10 heard about this, this is so typical, they became indignant with James and John. Now, these are the same guys that the last 3 or 4 times we've seen them alone by themselves, they've been arguing about which one of them was the most important. So they're not indignant because of how unspiritual James and John's question. They're indignant because nuts. there goes Vice President and Secretary of State. You know, they've got it locked in. So what's left? You know, Foreign Relations Committee, you know, Speaker of the House or something, you know, nuts. I was going to talk to him about that tomorrow. It's interesting. When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John, and Jesus called them together. In other words, this is going to sound very familiar because he just said this not too long ago. He realizes all 12 of them needed to hear this. He said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them," the NIV says. The verb means to dominate, to cause others to be subjugated to your authority. Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. The next four words are the four most flagrantly violated words of all of the commands of Jesus historically. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give away his life as a ransom for many. So clear. It's so repeated. This is some of the most frequently repeated instruction that Jesus gave this disciple. And that's as far as we'll get today. It's interesting, though, they didn't remember it. You'd think with the historical perspective of having the words written down, of looking at the whole story, that we would never make this mistake in the organized church. And yet it's the most flagrantly violated, as I said. And these are its commands. I mean, it's not a suggestion or a request or, you know, this is my leadership style and, you know, you find your own, whatever works. No, these are commands. So the fact that it's repeated means we need to hear it more than once. Let's back up and just, there's some great stuff in these few vignettes. On their way up to Jerusalem, verse 32. I do find the wording kind of interesting. It says the disciples, Jesus was leading the way, and the disciples were astonished. It's an interesting word. And you wonder, well, what was so astonishing about Jesus leading the way? And I think it doesn't tell us, but there's knowing the prevailing train of thought, it could be one of two things. They could have been just shocked that he was leading the way instead of lost in the thousands of the multitude of people, because he's headed right into the hotbed of hostility. People who wanted to kill him. And he's leading the way. As we look at this whole, all of the events that take place over the next few chapters as Jesus has set his face, the Bible says, like flint, set his face toward the cross. The one thing that's so, I think, touching and inspiring to me is he had no support. They were not even on the same page as him. They did not know what to expect. I think the most likely reason that they were astonished, that euphoric feeling, was that they thought this was it. They thought he's going to set up his kingdom. And of course, as soon as they got to Jerusalem, is when the triumphal entry happened, and people are yelling messianic cheerleading phrases, and they're throwing palm branches down, and the disciples are thinking, despite what he told them, they're thinking, this is it. This is when he kicks out the Romans and he sets up the kingdom. So it could be one or both of those things. The reason that they were astonished that he was leading was simply that he was walking right into the teeth of the lion, right into the headquarters of the enemies. And of course, we know why he did it, don't we? because he was determined to do what his father told him to do, even if nobody understood it, even if he didn't have support because of fear or because of misguided delusions. And I always think there's a time in our lives, if we're going to be serious followers, when God will ask us to do something simply because he asked us to do it, and he's not going to, and we're not going to have all kinds of support from our family, from our friends. They may actually think we're nuts. They may have a completely different idea about the way it's going to go down. I think that if we are going to enjoy what the Bible calls the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, there is a closeness with Jesus that happens anytime I do what I'm doing, and I know nobody's understanding except him, and I do it because he asked me to. It's a wonderful thing. It's one of those things. I tell you, I have suffered in my life because of being stupid. Most of the time, my suffering is my own fault. Once in a while, I've suffered because I did what God asked me to do. And I don't know how to explain this to you unless it's happened to you, but there's this amazing thing that happens in your heart when you realize, I am getting beat up because I'm obeying Jesus. Yippee! I don't know how to explain it, especially if you've been a person that got beat up just because of being obnoxious or being foolish and bullheaded. So I love this example. I love that there's all kinds of mixed feelings. The crowds are terrified. Strong word. Because they know that this controversial figure leading the way up into Jerusalem, walking in the time where there's going to be several million people from all over the world crammed into this city, that he is not going to walk in and be there without there being some bloodshed. And the ones that thought he was going to kick out the Romans thought, well, it'll be bloody, but at least we'll get our freedom. The ones who understood the resistance that he was going to receive to the religious leaders, I don't blame them for being afraid. I do find it interesting that he was leading the way. Not sort of melting into the crowd, sort of laying low till the right time. I have discovered this also. If you wait till you've got support all around you before you do some things God asks you to do, you'll never do it. There may be times when you have to lead the way. There may be times when you say, okay, though none go with me, still I will follow. So, mixed emotions, Jesus leading the way. I think there's an answer to the why that I always ask, where it says, again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. There is a, and I always write, why did he do that? Why repeat himself that many times? There's only really one answer, because it was going to happen, whether they believed it or not. It wasn't for him. It was pure love. It was for them. Don't you find it kind of interesting that when he lays out this whole thing there in verse 33 and 34, he knew exactly what was going to happen. Every detail, the whole scenario, he knew exactly how it was going to end up. He wasn't shocked. He wasn't surprised. In fact, as we watch it unfold, it almost looks like he's in charge. He seems to be the one that's under control in Gethsemane and before Pilate, before Herod. Their expectations were just so wrong. And he just didn't want them to be taken by surprise. In fact, in John's account of the events of the last week of Jesus, John quotes Jesus as saying, I have told you all of this in advance so that when it happens, you'll remember that I told you. What kindness. I know I've talked with Bill about this many times as he's teaching Revelation to the teens. That's the purpose of the book of Revelation. It's so that when all of this unbelievable, unprecedented stuff is going down, we realize that God wrote this down. God knew it was all going to happen. It's all according to plan, so we won't freak out. So we'll feel secure. It's the least scary book in the world, the book of Revelation, if you understand who it's pointing to. And if your treasure is in heaven and not on earth. But it was told to us in such graphic detail just so we wouldn't be taken by surprise, and I found that so comforting. Has God ever told you anything in advance that you wish you'd listened to because you forgot it, and later on you went through all that needless, you know, fear and worry, and then when it all went down the way that he said it was, you look back and you realize, you know what, he told me that. So I wrote this little note down. It says that, I checked this out, but every place where he told them that he was going to die, he also told them that he was going to raise from the dead. He told them the whole story. He told them the good, the bad, and the ugly, and the final triumph. He didn't leave stuff out so that nothing would take them by surprise. And of course, that's a really good picture of the book of Revelation too, isn't it? It's a really good picture of the whole Christian life. If I want to follow his agenda and his plan, there are plenty of examples in Scripture of him just telling people, maybe not in as great of detail, but telling people the stuff they needed to know ahead of time so they wouldn't be blown away. I wrote this down. I said, what different people they could have been when it all went down, if they'd have just remembered everything that he'd said. Even in this one statement, which he repeated many times. One of my favorite quotes about suffering, it's a perspective thing, comes from Elizabeth Elliot. It's one of those grab handle quotes. She said this in one of her books about suffering, and I can't remember which one it was because she's written several. She said, suffering is part of the plot of a wonderful love story. We talked about this in great detail in Job, that if you're living out Job's life in a linear way, there was a while there it would have been incredibly depressing. But if you look at that period of suffering as just one chapter in the book, so to speak, and the end of Job's life was better than the beginning. It's always that way for the believer. Your story and my story is a love story that's already written. You read the end and you realize this turns out really good for us. But suffering's part of that plot. And if I'm trying to avoid it, rip that page out of the book, there may be some things I'm missing. And of course, that was the problem with the disciples, wasn't it? And you can tell it by the question that they got their mom, these two guys got their mom to ask, that all they were looking at was the glory. Jesus was about to do the most remarkable thing that had ever been done on this planet, in the whole solar system. I mean, he was about to do the greatest thing ever done for humans. And it was going to look like a complete and total chaotic failure for them because they didn't hear what he said. I always picture them after he's crucified. Of course, that would be gruesome to see your best friend, your buddy, brutally murdered and you know, trumped up charges and a mockery of a trial. But if they'd remembered this part, that after 3 days he will rise, it would have been a 3-day tailgate party in the garden tomb, wouldn't it? I mean, they would have just been, you know, having the brats on the Barbie there, and then along about maybe, let's say, the last 10 minutes, they'd be starting the countdown. 10, 9, the little ball would be dropping down in Times Square, because instead, what were they doing? Well, we saw last week in 1 Peter that Peter said that their hope died temporarily till the resurrection. Then their hope could never die.